Hello, Cornelians. Welcome to another episode of Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornelians. I'm John Rollins III, class of 2006, and the 16th president of the Cornell Black Alumni Association. I'm here today with Ahmed Ahmed, class of 2017. Ahmed is currently a medical student at Harvard Medical School, and I am really excited that we're able to speak with him today. Ahmed, welcome to Fresh from the Hill.
Thanks so much, John. I really appreciate it. It's a real privilege and an honor to share in conversation with you. So thanks for having me.
Of course. Absolutely. Now, before we dive all the way in, I think we share a connection in terms of you were raised in some part of Maryland, I understand.
Yeah, I was.
Okay. What part were you from?
So I was raised in Prince George's County, Maryland, originally in Riverdale, Maryland, and then my family moved to Greenbelt, Maryland.
Okay, cool. I'm from the Wheaton side, Wheaton Silver Spring side of Maryland in Montgomery County. But I love PG County. I must say that.
For sure. Silver Spring's right by.
That's right. Exactly. Not far away at all. So, Ahmed, you have a really powerful story. And when Amanda, our producer, brought your name into, one of the individuals we would want to talk to this season, I was really excited because I actually remember reading several articles about you, some from Cornell, The Washington Post, and some other outlets as well, about your incredible story. And as one article put it, you went from being a refugee to being a Rhodes Scholar, which I think is absolutely amazing. So I was going to ask you if you could, share maybe a little bit of that story, what I could call your origin story, and let folks know kind of pre-Cornell, how life was for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting because I think a lot of the articles and coverage surrounding my story really begin to take place where I was born, which is a refugee camp in Mombasa, Kenya. But how I see my story really begins prior to that. So my family is actually originally from Somalia, and they're from Mogadishu, Somalia. And at the time in the early 90s, there was a civil war happening in the country. And so there was a lot of civil unrest. Civil war began to envelop Mogadishu and the city where my family was. And so by 1994, things just, the upheaval and really the security began to collapse within the city. And so my family ended up leaving Somalia and really following a sort of beaten path to Mombasa, Kenya, to a refugee camp there, where we kind of sat and waited for asylum. And that's where I was born, was in that refugee camp. And it was a year later that my family and I were granted an opportunity to immigrate to the United States and then to Prince George's County, Maryland, particularly. So that's sort of really the beginnings of my life, but much of the life that I've known really was growing up in the United States, and growing up mainly in low-income environments. So when we first immigrated to the United States, my family and I were a family of 10. I'm the youngest of 8, and we were living in a two-bedroom apartment. And so it was like my parents had one room, and then the other room was just whoever could sort of fight over it and get it. And everybody else was kind of sleeping around in the living room and anywhere else that you could find a place to sleep. And that was quite an experience because I think for my family, we always had these grander visions really of the country and the opportunity ahead. But the struggle really is realizing that the reality of growing up poor and Black in America is really a struggle in and of itself, and hard to ever gain that sort of mobility that I think a lot of people aspire to and believe in. So that was really much of my life kind of growing up young in Maryland before then eventually my parents divorce, we moved to Minnesota, and that's a story in and of itself that I'm more than happy to dive into if you're interested, but.
No, absolutely. I mean, I will say I've never been to Minnesota. That's a state that I've never been to. What was life like being in Minnesota?
So it's funny. So what moved my mother to Minnesota was at that time, my grandparents and her siblings were living in Minneapolis. And what's interesting about Minneapolis is while the Somali community is the minority community, much of the Somali community within the United States resides in Minneapolis and in Minnesota. So 25% of the U.S. Somali population is in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. So there's a strong community, but still a minority community within Minnesota at large. And so we ended up making the move to Rochester, Minnesota. And if you know the state of Minnesota, it's like there's really sort of two metropolitan areas, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester, which in the early 2000s had less than 100,000 people. It was a predominantly white evangelical town nestled in the southeastern corner of the state. And my mother really just moved there because she didn't want to be in Minneapolis, like directly adjacent to my grandparents, but wanted to be nearby. And so Rochester was really the only other place that she could think of moving to. So we moved to Rochester, and it's three of my siblings and I and my mother. My older siblings at that time were older than 18, had dropped out of high school, and were pursuing much of the same work that my parents had worked, which was factory work. My mother was working as a hotel maid in Rochester, and we then made the move there. And that was quite an interesting dynamic, because the thing about Prince George's County and the DMV area where we grew up was, yeah, we were low income, but a lot of the people around us were too. And we felt very fortunate and privileged that we had two parents at home. My parents were both working. My mother deeply valued education. And they sort of sheltered us really and kept us insulated away from a lot of the pressures in that environment. But when we moved to Minnesota, and in Rochester in particular, now it was just like my entire environment had changed. Rochester has the Mayo Clinic, which is the top hospital in the country, and it really takes up a large part of the town. So it's like everyone's parents are affiliated typically with the Mayo Clinic in some way, be it your parents being physicians there or nurses. And also at that time when we moved there, it had one of the largest IBM firms in the world also in the city. So it was like if your parents weren't in medicine, they were probably in engineering. And so for my mother now working as a hotel maid in the city, it made for this odd sort of paradox and contrast where I'm navigating this school district where everyone's like, they expect to go to college. They know they're going to college, and their parents and their environment expects that of them. And now I just kind of get this 180 flip where I never saw myself in college, never saw myself pursuing higher education because my older siblings hadn't. And now I was in an environment that had those expectations and held really students to that standard, but also at the same time navigating a predominantly white school district as a Black student. And that came with its own sort of racial tensions and challenges as well.
I can imagine. So that is, again, a powerful story that you shared. And so now that leads me to wonder how we go from, you know, coming from Kenya, PG County, Minnesota, and then we somehow find our way to Ithaca, New York, right? So what brought you to Cornell? Like, what was your introduction to Cornell, and what made you decide this was the place for you?
You know, I really credit a lot of my decision-making in high school and where I eventually going to Cornell, much of the credit goes to my sister. So I was fortunate because of the three siblings that I really mainly grew up with in Minnesota, my oldest sister made the bulk of the sacrifice in our family so that her younger siblings and me included could have an opportunity to really be our best selves and be able to pursue all that we eventually did. So my sister at the time was incredibly driven, really was devoted / motivated to pursue higher education, even in a context and an environment that didn't expect women to do so. So my sister was really, within the Somali culture, was expected to drop out of school, get married, have kids, and be a stay-at-home mother. And she never really accepted that. And so she made a lot of sacrifices where even in high school, growing up in Rochester, my mother eventually ended up getting hurt at work. And so then my sister ended up taking up a job as a senior in high school where she would work the overnights and then during the days would come pick us up, drop us off at school, and then go to high school herself. And that's just like something no 18-year-old should ever have to do, and something she bare the burden of. So I always followed her advice and her guidance because she led by example. And at this time, my sister was actually in Boston, and she was doing research at MGH, where she was doing a few gap years before applying to medical school. And she had guided me much of the way through high school. When I got to high school, she was like, no, I want you to take the honors and AP classes. I know you're capable of it. I didn't personally think I was, but I just followed her advice. And by the time I was wrapping up high school, I had done well and academically was doing really well. And I was quite involved as well within our high school. And I just had really large dreams. And in some ways, they were very naive. Like my standardized test scores were terrible. and you know, like there are always these like graphs that you can very easily just Google for any institution where it shows you like the GPA on the y-axis or x-axis and then the standardized test score on the y. And then you go to the top right corner, right? It's like there's all the green and blue dots of people who got in. And then as you sort of shift over, you start seeing more and more red dots. Like I was sitting in a pool of red dots. And I have no idea why I decided to apply to the institutions that I did, besides honestly her unwavering belief and faith in my candidacy to these schools. So when I was a senior in high school, I actually didn't know where Cornell was. I had not even heard of Cornell University. And at that time, as I was preparing my applications, my sister actually sort of tapped me on the shoulder and was like, hey, there's this great school in upstate New York that I think you would really enjoy and get just a really powerful, meaningful experience. I think you should consider applying. So I sent in my application and I was really fortunate to have gotten into Cornell. And I actually, they had their regular decision day. And then I heard like maybe 2 weeks prior from the Cornell Tradition Fellowship through this letter that was like, hey, like we sort of tap you for this Cornell Tradition Fellowship. And I'm like, is this an acceptance? Like I haven't even heard back from the institution yet. And so I'm Googling what this letter even means. And then, you know, a lot of people online were like, well, I think that means that you sort of got into the university. And what sealed it for me at that time was diversity hosting weekend at Cornell. And because I hadn't visited the school, in fact, I didn't visit any of the schools that I applied to. And here was a way that I could actually go see the institution. Cornell and the Alumni Association also were funding a lot of the trip. And so it made it affordable for me. And when I visited it, I just fell in love with Cornell. My host is someone who I still keep in contact with today. And he was a senior at the time. And we had really deep, just meaningful conversations throughout the weekend. I recognized Cornell as a place where I could pivot and even study other things beyond what I was interested in at that time, in case I had ever had a change of heart and wanted to study something else. And then the financial aid package came in and I realized it was far more affordable than I had expected it to be. And so in the end, with all of those things considered, I ended up deciding to come to Cornell. And what's actually funny is for the longest time, because the larger thing about, you know, like, how did you decide to apply and attend this school in upstate New York? My mother actually never even knew where Cornell was until graduation when she finally came to campus. And so for the longest time that I was like, yeah, mom, I go to school in New York. But she imagined like New York City. And she shows up for graduation day and she sees like, it's really not New York City, it's upstate New York. I think for her, it was like, oh, this is where you've been. So it was quite the journey to decide to come to Cornell, and really a fortuitous route that I had for people who sort of gave me just great advice to apply.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, one that just speaks to that family support and how important that is. And I often hear that from Cornellians that I speak with, you know, about how other individuals maybe were the ones to kind of push them to consider Cornell, to, you know, really look at Cornell. I can't even tell you, I had the same story about the acceptance letter. I got a full tuition scholarship from an organization. Now, they were connected to Cornell, but I didn't realize how connected it was. But the scholarship was specifically to go to Cornell. And I said, how are they sending me this if I haven't even gotten an admissions letter from Cornell at this point? And then, of course, like a week later, I get the big envelope. I was like, oh, I guess I am in this place. So that is absolutely hilarious. But I love the fact that, you know, you had your family behind you. I love the fact that your mother didn't know and realized that it was in upstate New York until graduation. That is wonderful. But I'm sure she is just as proud of you, you know, now as she was back then. So you did a lot of stuff at Cornell. You were very engaged. I saw that you were a part of Habitat for Humanity. You volunteered as a Cornell EMT, which is a very important role on campus. But I wanted to focus a little bit on SWAG. And for those who don't know what SWAG is, Students Working Ambitiously to Graduate. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that community, that experience, and what that meant to you being on campus.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, when I stepped on campus, it was quite a difficult transition coming to Cornell, particularly coming from a public high school where I went to school in Rochester. There weren't a lot of students who were leaving the state to go to college, and very few students were going on to elite universities. And I even remember when I got into Cornell, I had this teacher who even pulled me aside one day and asked me if I thought I had gotten into Cornell because I was Black. And I was really struggling when I got there, in part because of the pressures I already felt back home. My admission to Cornell was covered by the local paper. It meant a lot in the Somali community. And I recognized this sort of degree as larger than myself and one that I really wanted to utilize to pay forward for my family. So I arrived to campus with a lot of pressures, and honestly, in some ways, even my transition to campus, my first night was kind of a reflection of just all that I experienced in that first semester. I had my flight like delayed, ended up flying into Syracuse because I couldn't afford to fly into Ithaca. There's no good transportation from Syracuse to Ithaca. It's better to just fly into New York and take the bus up. Didn't know that. End up finally coming to campus at like 2 a.m. struggling to find my place, and then finally find I lived in the townhouses on North Campus, finally find my townhouse, arrive. My roommates are all well set up because their parents had helped set up the room. My family wasn't even able to make it to campus because of the financial burden of it all. I threw down a towel, and literally my roommate wakes me up at like 6 a.m. to him ironing his shirt. And it was just like, he was so thoroughly prepared for that experience. And I love him. He's a great friend that I still keep in contact with. But I think it was a reflection of just how well prepared he was for college and the experience and the lack of preparedness that I had on my end. Mm-hmm. And so when I got to Cornell, academically, it was as much of a struggle as even the move-in was for me. So I got there, and one, I didn't understand how college finances even worked, in terms of taking out loans and when you should and how much you should take out. So I was penny pinching, because I was like, oh my God, like any debt that I take out, it's really going to hurt me in the long term. And there wasn't much debt that I was taking out throughout my time at Cornell, but I was even doing things like the dining hall meal plan. Like I would get 7 meals a week, which is one a day, right? And I remember my roommate one time stopping me in the first semester and was like, you know, it seems like you're always getting headaches. Like, is everything okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm good, you know, and I'm totally not. I'm not eating. I'm constantly taking aspirin to make the headaches go away. I'm struggling academically. Like I was putting all of my effort into school, yet I wasn't doing well. And I even like had saved the marks that I got on my first paper, my first exam, where I had done substantially less than the average in our class, and didn't know who I could turn to. And at that time, I couldn't really turn to my sister because she hadn't had this kind of experience before, to be in an environment where it was just so academically rigorous and there were so many expectations of Cornell students. And there were very few even Black students that I could really find and look to in terms of sharing in this experience of just like, is this me? Am I the one who doesn't belong here? Did they make a mistake? And all that is to say, that first semester was rough for me. And I eventually reached out to my sister, who was in a relationship with her boyfriend at the time, who he was a medical student at Stanford. And he had gone to Amherst for undergrad. And I figured he could help me sort of navigate this situation. And I remember when I called him and I was crying literally by BB Lake, because I had just done so poor on my first prelims. He was just like, reach out to your professors. Like they want to help you. So I did. And I was grateful that I had that experience early on. But what I realized, because it really changed my life, because from there, I realized I could reach out to others for help and that it's there. It's though it might not always look like it's there, people are ready and willing to help. And so things began to then turn around for me. But what I quickly grew to realize was this was a larger problem. This wasn't just a problem with me and my transition. This is a problem that a lot of underrepresented students at Cornell face. And you can experience it and see it firsthand, particularly in the pre-med curriculum as you're navigating through. And I remember this like implicit nature of weed out culture and students getting weeded out. And it was by the end of my experience that I really began to ask myself, like, who is getting weeded out? Like, who is not doing well in these courses? Because when you begin to ask that question, what you realize is often students coming from public high schools. It's often students who are underrepresented. And the thing about pre-med is it's this weird environment where you don't actually, like, we don't have good numbers on who was once pre-med and then who's pre-med now, because it's really a more internal decision. We don't keep track of it in any way. And we don't know why students decide to no longer be pre-med. What we do know or aspire to really is that someone's making that decision for themselves and not dictated by a poor grade that they received. And so that was one thing I had rumbling in my head. Another was recognizing that retention and graduation for Black students at Cornell is disparate compared to other racial identities. And SWAG really focused on that mission and recognized that there has to be more done to help bridge this gap. And we are fortunate to be resourceful and recognize that we have upperclassmen who are well-achieving, who are going to go on to do incredible things and want to pay that forward for incoming students so that they don't have an experience like the one that I had. And that's really what drew me to SWAG. And I wish I had seen that group prior, like during my first semester, because it would have made a world of difference for me. And so I recognized by the time I was a junior, that I wanted to work with SWAG. I had a couple of friends who were in the program and were mentoring students and paying it forward. And so that's what I ended up really focusing on as well throughout my senior year. And it's a great sort of mentor-mentee one-to-one relationship where you can help students during this transition. And the thing about Cornell is like, everyone's got a high motor. Everyone wants to, you know, put all of their efforts and be as successful as possible and pay it forward. It's really direction that students often need and recognizing where to put those efforts and how to be resourceful. And SWAG sort of helps students develop that so that then by the time you're a sophomore, a junior, you sort of know how to best navigate Cornell and to be your best self and to be as successful as possible.
Absolutely. And I love that about I love that about Cornell, period, but I do specifically, I think about the organizations that have existed in our communities. I think about, you know, we had the Link Men's Alliance, right? And that's been at Cornell for a very long time. And I think at one point, I feel like the Link tried to do all of that at once, right? Really pulling in and helping make sure there was community, making sure that folks felt like they had a place, they belonged, that they were successful. And then I remember when I was on campus, I was one of the students that helped to start the Men of Color Conference and then subsequently the Men of Color Council. And, you know, so, and I think what we did was, even as a member of the Link e-board, we took that piece and said, okay, we want to now focus on the professional development aspects. And then a couple of years later, while I'm working at the college, I hear about SWAG. And I said, well, what is SWAG? What are they doing? And then really hearing about, one, not only the desire from folks to address those, you know, those rates of graduation, you know, to address success academically, but that the fact that it was a student-led initiative that was something like we are investing in ourselves and in our community. That's something that's really, really powerful. And I think for me, it really shows how much our community matters, right? Cornell is very rigorous, but you know, you've talked about it. We come together and we lean on one another. And so when you saw that you now were having a better experience and you found yourself more grounded, you said, how can I help someone else? And I think that's important in our community at Cornell, but also specifically within our Black student community at Cornell, which I still see going on today, which makes me so very happy. So you've, again, now we talked about all this stuff the way that I first heard about you was about the Rhodes Scholarship. And just for folks that maybe don't know, only 32 students a year in the United States are selected to become Rhodes Scholars to pursue degrees at Oxford. So what made you decide to apply to become a Rhodes Scholar? And what was that experience like? I mean, I'm sure that there was, as I saw the article, a lot of fanfare and excitement. And there always is when you hear about somebody being awarded that scholarship. But then you actually have to go and do the work. So talk a little bit about that experience.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that was, for me, it wasn't even anything, again, kind of similar to my experience at Cornell, where in high school, I wasn't really aware of the university and didn't, like, I wasn't making decisions based on this idea that I was one day going to go to Cornell. And during my time at Cornell, anything that I did or focused on or put all of my efforts into were never really focused on the Rhodes Scholarship. In fact, I hadn't heard of the Rhodes Scholarship either until my junior year at Cornell. And at that time, I was really focused on mentorship research as well. I was doing a lot of research surrounding how to make sustainable and reusable plastics, which is something I never would have imagined as a high schooler, but that was what I was focused on. And in teaching as well. And I really took my TAing work just as tried to hold myself to a high standard with that. And so by the time I was in my spring semester at Cornell, I was sort of the lead TA for this biochemistry course, and they hadn't had really a lead TA ever before that. And I was taking on much of the capacity and teaching that my professor was doing, in large part because I just had like come up to him and he offered me a TA position. And I told him like, I would love this, but I only want to do it with the idea that hopefully one day I can help teach some of your lectures. And he sort of looked at me bewildered and was like, dude, you're a sophomore. but he eventually, after the first semester of teaching, I was fortunate enough to have received an Excellence in Teaching Award. And then he sort of offered me this opportunity to take over some of his teaching in the spring semester. So there was a lot that I was doing that was just kind of different. And I had made it my own. And I had my own sort of flavor and twist to it. And so by my spring semester, I knew that I really wanted to apply to medical school. And I was preparing my applications for that. But my professor, who I was telling you about, who I was working closely with to help teach biochemistry, had told me about the Rhodes Scholarship and said, hey, like, I think you would be a great candidate for this and you should consider applying. I never once considered studying abroad. like I just got to put that out there, because the thing about my undergraduate studies were like, if I was already cutting sort of corners to try to minimize the amount of loans I was taking out, the thought of even studying abroad never crossed my mind. I was like, nope, I'm staying domestic because financially that makes no sense. My parent, like my mom is still struggling at home. My family's still financially in a tough place. And I can never imagine leaving the country to go study somewhere else. But when he told me about this scholarship that would fully fund my studies at Oxford, I began to really think and reflect on it more. And particularly for me, it was because I was interested in things beyond medicine. And it partially stemmed from my experiences at Cornell, where I was seeing students who were struggling academically, who needed more support. And I wanted to focus and really direct my attention toward how do we increase representation in medicine as well. And in medicine, there's this idea of a leaky pipeline from undergraduate to medical school and actually applying to medical school, where we lose a lot of students and a lot of diversity before even the application gets submitted. And that was something that I really gravitated toward in terms of working on. So at this time, I then decided like, okay, I'll also apply for the Rhodes. He sort of primed me and was mentally preparing me that it's a long shot, give it a shot, but also prepare to go to medical school if it doesn't work out. So I had my medical school applications, everything ready, and I was also applying for Rhodes. Initially, I only intended to apply for the Rhodes. And then after Cornell has an endorsement committee process and you have to apply through them, and then you can apply nationally to the actual scholarship itself. And as I was going through Cornell's endorsement process, they also recommended, like literally on a whim, were like, we think you should apply for Marshall too. So I was like, okay, sounds good. Like I hadn't heard about that, but okay, I'll look into the scholarship and apply. Look, and it's like the application deadline's in like 5 days. So I'm like, okay, I'll just put together the best application I can, submitted it, and was fortunate enough to be selected for a finalist for both scholarships.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was something I remain forever just kind of fortunate and grateful for. So both of the interviews were in Chicago, 1 week apart, and I ended up applying. I was interviewing with the Marshall Committee first, and they made me rethink, like, if I should really even be studying abroad. I mean, they kind of, the interview experience I had was just not a pleasant one, and it made me rethink and question if I even was taking the right sense of direction, in large part because they kind of just looked at my application and were like, this is overly ambitious / doesn't make any sense, because there's not really anyone working on these kinds of things within medicine. Like, why do you want to pursue an MD degree? So I then thought on that and reflected on it more, and I realized, like, there was nothing wrong with my dream. There was everything wrong with the fact that no one had ever pursued something like this before, where you could actually do something beyond medical school and medicine and also say, I want to bridge in research that focuses on addressing this issue. And so the following week, I then had my interview with the Rhodes Committee, and that they actually gravitated a lot more to what I had to say and the experiences that I had. And I was fortunate enough to then be awarded a scholarship that weekend. And honestly, in a matter of 24 hours, it's just like your entire life changes. So many emails come through your email inbox, and the world really sort of, like, there was nothing that changed in terms of me the day prior to winning the Rhodes and the day after winning Rhodes. The only thing that changed was that people now sort of knew who I was, and I recognized with that came an immense amount of responsibility to do something with it. And I was awarded a Rhodes at a very odd time in this country. It was 2016. The election's tone, temperament was incredibly heated, and a lot of it was directed at immigrants and refugees, an identity in which I hold dear, near and dear to my heart, and believe to have defined a lot of my viewpoints on life. So after I was awarded the Rhodes and Trump eventually takes office in 2017, and his rhetoric begins to become far more inflammatory, and the decisions and the policies coming out of the administration, there ended up being a travel ban, of which Somalia was on the list. And things began to grow quite sort of personal for me, my family, and really my identity as well. And I recognized that there were a lot of people who were being affected by these decisions harmfully. And I had a responsibility to say and do something about it. And it began to spark a lot of the advocacy that I then engaged in beyond that point.
Incredible. I mean, just the stuff that you're sharing, I think, is already inspiring so many people, right? And guess what, folks? There is more, right? Because right now you are studying at Harvard Medical School. You know, you're working towards your MD degree. You were awarded the P.D. Soros Fellowship for New Americans. And so that's an incredible fellowship in what you're, you know, working under right now. And I can only imagine, I've had friends, I actually have one of my closest friends from Cornell, went through Harvard Medical School as well, and, you know, talked about how much he loved it, how much he learned, and how impactful it was. But I can only imagine that right now, in the midst of a global pandemic, being in medical school is probably a bit of a different kind of experience. So tell us about that experience, and for you, what is it like to study medicine in the midst of a global pandemic?
Wow, it is such a just interesting time, I think, right now to be in medicine, because this pandemic has spotlighted so many gaps within our healthcare system at large, in the hospital, outside of the hospital. And I think for me, recognizing that it really, when you begin to identify these holes and how they disparately impact the same group of people, time and time again, be it access to a hospital, be it access to even working from home and quarantining, a lot of these public health measures and recommendations that we have that in some ways it's harder for some people to be able to do than others. I think it just kind of makes you step back with humility and recognize there's a lot of work to be done in this country in terms of healthcare at large. And so there's never been a more meaningful and important time to be in healthcare and really to be an active citizen also in society. One thing that I recognize now is that, and what I've known for a while really, and a lot of research shows that much of people's health outcomes, not surprisingly, is determined by what happens outside of the hospital. Where you live, where you play, where you work, a lot of those social determinants of health very heavily fuel and drive health outcomes and also what we then see in the hospital or who we don't see in the hospital. And that's been something I've been very weary of and mindful of and working on that. So right now, a lot of the things that I focus on early in the pandemic was oriented toward how can we best address this sort of differential impact that's happening in the pandemic. So I work at a free clinic and volunteer at a free clinic where we provide care independent of cost to those who often aren't able to access care within the greater Boston and Cambridge area. And what we realized for a lot of our communities were when the pandemic hit, these were folks who were getting hit by COVID and who weren't able to go to the hospital or see a doctor. And so then we started mobilizing mobile clinics that would meet people in their communities and begin to both pass helpful health information, because there's a lot of health misinformation floating around, but also begin to provide care, chronic care management long-term as well. And then also another thing that I sort of worked on was after the pandemic hit, for a lot of kids, there was a lot of food insecurity because they were being pulled out of school. And for students who, like myself, relied on free and reduced price lunches, literally for daily nutrition, there was no sort of bridging of that gap of like, okay, well, what do we do for these students now who are no longer able to access those meals, whose parents and families depended on heavily? And there was a sort of small line within the Family First Coronavirus Act that was passed that focused on bridging this gap and was going to reimburse families for the cost of these missed meals. The issue was, while this was a federal program through the USDA, I think it was about a month and a half, 2 months into the pandemic, only three states had actually opted in to literally these free federal dollars that were going to address the food insecurity that we were seeing. And so I ended up writing about that for a while and actually emailing and sort of petitioning to our own Department of like Health and Human Security in Minnesota. And eventually Minnesota then finally ended up opting in, more states opted in, and now that at least has been better addressed than it was when the pandemic first hit. And so I think the biggest thing for healthcare providers at this time and anyone in medicine is stepping back and realizing that what we're seeing in the hospitals is not the only thing that is going on in this country in terms of disparate health outcomes. There are a lot of things that we have to do in terms of food security, housing security, and other social determinants to help people live as best as they can during this difficult time.
Absolutely. And you recognizing those intersections, I think, is so important and so vital. And I'm glad that you have used, you know, what you're doing and what you're learning to make sure that you're also advocating at the same time. That's really powerful. As we start to kind of wrap up, I know that there, of course, are a lot of alumni and young alumni who are listening to the podcast today, but I also know that many of our students are listening. I know that they're inspired by your story. They're inspired by your words. If you could leave a thought with our students who are, you know, currently going through Cornell, much like you and I did, or not much like you and I did, because they're going through it in this global pandemic. What is something that you would say to them in this moment?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, what I would say is you're not alone. I really wish I had known that there is such a strong alumni network and people who really love Cornell, and we care so much about the institution that if you reached out to any of us, we like with open arms, we'd be willing to help and support any mission and any dream that you have to help make the world better. It is just such a needed time right now for Cornell students to do anything that you sort of can to help. And what I mean by that is I think I recognized that when I was on campus, I was heavily focused on my studies and what was happening on campus. And I certainly encourage students to do that. But with any Cornell degree, there is an immense amount of privilege and opportunity that comes upon graduation. And with it comes an immense amount of responsibility, but also recognizing that the opportunity to study at Cornell was really in large part driven for you to then do something with that education. And there are so many people who want to support your dreams and your missions. And it is through that that we're able to sort of uplift and find ourselves in a better state, really, as a country and also as a world. And so for Cornell students right now, I imagine it's probably, like you said, John, a really difficult, challenging time where the experiences that you and I had in college certainly don't reflect the challenges the university is facing right now. And there are a lot of sacrifices being made by students, by admin, all around. But know that you're not alone and that we're with you and we stand with you. And if there is any way that we can support you, don't ever hesitate to reach out to a Cornell alum, because we love our alma mater. And it's a revolutionary institution that has just embodied so many ideas that now are staple and they're commonplace, but in the context of the times that it embodied those ideas, they were revolutionary. And so I also encourage students that if you have a bold vision to do something, then embrace the ideals of Cornell and really put your foot forward in that.
Absolutely. You know, I think that's advice that really alumni can hold on to as well, right? Remembering that we have this community to lean on one another, to support one another, because I often say that Cornellians across the board are often leaders and those that are really leading in their communities. But when you need that kind of maybe break from your leadership or take a pause, a step back to reflect, to rest, right? I like to think that sometimes, at least for me, that's where I find it within my Cornell family, my Cornell Black Alumni Association family, being able to engage with them and to communicate with them, and then really get that energy to go back out, you know, the next day and continue to do that thing that we are meant to do. So I appreciate those words. Last question for you, and I initially told you it was going to be just your favorite spot on campus, but I want to know, as we end, what is one of your favorite spots on campus, and maybe what is one event or program that you remember from campus that you enjoyed while you were at Cornell?
Yeah. So my favorite spot on campus, and it's actually changed a bit since I graduated, but it absolutely has to be the Hill. The Hill is okay. It's like in the summertime, the one time where it warms up on campus and in Ithaca, just being out on the Hill and sort of just laying down a blanket and chilling there is nothing like it. In terms of events that Cornell hosts, it's interesting because now as an alum, I really look forward to any kind of like alumni events that are hosted or even the five-year reunion that our class will have coming up in about 2 years. I think during my time on campus, the most fun I had actually was, and I believe it was an Alpha Phi Alpha 8, their Black and Gold Night.
Oh, probably the... Was it Miss Black and Gold pageant or?
Yes, Miss Black and Gold pageant. Oh my gosh. It was the performances, the just elegance and beauty of the entire experience to see our Black community coming together and just celebrating and not thinking about academics or anything like that. And everybody was dressed to the nine. It was, it was just an experience that forever lives with me. And I look back on the pictures and I just smile because it was among the most meaningful times I had.
That's wonderful. Well, as a member of Alpha Phi Alpha, I will thank you for that memory and to the brothers of the Alpha chapter who continue to put on amazing programs and events and really serving our community at Cornell. Ahmed, we are so grateful that you have made time to be on this podcast. Thank you so much for sharing with us and continuing to inspire folks. I know that you will do so many great things in the world and continue to represent Cornell so well in the future. So thank you for being a part of this.
For sure. Thank you so much, John. I really appreciate it. I appreciate you having me on. And to all the Cornell alumni, go Big Red.
That's right. So thank you all so much for listening today. Please be sure to like, rate, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find out more information about Young Alumni programs and how to get involved at alumni.cornell.edu/youngalumni, and also by following the Facebook page at Young Alumni Programs. You can also learn more about the Cornell Black Alumni Association at cbaa1976.com, and follow us on all of our social media platforms at cbaa1976. Music from Fresh from the Hill was written, produced, and recorded by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2013, and you can contact him at koa3@cornell.edu. If you have ideas for the podcast that you would like to share, please email our incredible producer, Amanda Massa, at amanda.massa, that's M-A-S-S-A, at cornell.edu. Again, thank you so much for listening, and we can't wait to see you again soon.